Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. 17 Iraqi citizens were killed back in 2007 by a team working for Blackwater, the private security contractor. And this event intensified a kind of a conversation that at that point had been going on for some time. And the central question was, what law would apply to people like this, the Blackwater employees in Iraq? It seemed to be pretty clear that as the result of an action of the Coalition Provisional Authority some years before, it seemed pretty clear that they were not covered by Iraqi law. Some people also pointed out that since these actions took place outside of the United States, that the Blackwater employees were not covered by American law. And further, they said that since they were not regular military employees, in a sense, they were not uniformed soldiers, they were also not covered by military law. And it made it appear that that meant that these Blackwater employees weren't covered by any law at all. Now, as a result of a new kind of agreement between U.S. and Iraq, it would appear that at least at this point, such a thing, if it happened today, would be covered by the law of Iraq. And now, fairly recently, these Blackwater employees have been charged here in the United States in connection with all of this. But there still seem to be some questions about just what sort of law and in what way covers these folks and other private security contractors working in a place like Iraq. That's the question we'll try to take on here this morning on Focus 580. And we'll be talking with an attorney who has a lot of experience dealing with defense industry issues and government contractors. And she's done a lot of speaking and writing on issues related to battlefield contractors, oversight, and liability. Her name is Tara Lee. She's a partner in the law firm DLA Piper LLC. She is also former military lawyer. She was graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, and after that, she served as a naval officer in several commands and then transferred to the Judge Adjutant General Corps. She received an award, the American Trial Lawyers Association Outstanding Military Trial Advocate Award, for her work there. She's also a member of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Law and National Security, and on behalf of the ABA has led teams of attorneys in producing white papers looking at military law and how it may apply to contractors on the battlefield. She's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone is welcome to call. Ms. Lee, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm very well. Thanks for
Good.
Having me on.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Myself, I feel wading into this area very quickly, getting in over my head. Perhaps sometimes even for someone who is a specialist in this area, it can
very
seem confusing.
True.
Maybe a way to start the conversation or kind of set up some of our topics for conversation is simply just to ask the question, and I think probably we want to try to talk generally. I don't know how much specifically you can say about this particular case of these Blackwater employees that are now facing charges in connection with this shooting, this event that took place back in September 2007. But, you know, generally speaking, what do you think are the significant questions or the significant issues here that attach to this or similar kind of situations that you could imagine?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two ways of looking at it. You can look very specifically at the individual cases and the individuals charged and go through the sort of jurisdictional objections that each side might raise and look at it in that narrow and specific way, or you can take it from sort of a more macro view and try to discuss and resolve where we ought to bring what kinds of crimes, because the category of contractor killings on the battlefield can actually be a pretty wide continuum from an off-duty murder all the way to a disproportionate use of force on the battlefield. And we now have three examples that fit in different places on that continuum, one of them being the Nisour Square incident, and they're each things that have been in the news and are very public. And I think that might be one way of looking at what do we feel like is the right way to address potential wrongdoing. I think in part it depends on what kind of wrongdoing it might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that you would be the first to say that while you as an attorney might indeed find yourself in a position of representing somebody who might have been accused in a case like this, mm-hmm. that you seemed very strongly, and I'm sure that that everybody involved in this issue would very strongly say accountability is very important. And
yeah,
that people who commit wrongful acts must indeed be held accountable. So that you would in no way excuse somebody who was involved in the situation.
No, one of the things that I tend to point out as I do these discussions is that I do an awful lot of work, thousands of hours last year and the year before on the other side of the issue as well. I have cases pending on behalf of human rights victims from Somalia in the 1980s. Who were the victims of extrajudicial killings and torture during the conflict that led to the fall of the Barre regime at the end of the 1980s. It by no means is limited to one side or the other. A lot of my good friends in the human rights community share some of my opinions about the importance of assigning the right kind of accountability mechanism when you're looking at a jurisdictional framework. So I do think that the call for accountability is appropriate. I think some of the media attention on individual actions sort of blurs the lines a little bit, and it's very, very easy to focus on the wrong things when you're talking about the importance of accountability. But, you know, these things tend to go in cycles, and they're not by any means unique to the current conflict in Iraq or even Afghanistan. They're much more long-reaching back in history than just now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take specifically as much as we can this particular case, the case now that has been in the news with the Blackwater employees that are charged in the shooting that took place in September 2007. Let me first ask this question. Well, It seemed to be at the time that and as a result, and maybe you can flesh this out, as a result of this order that had been put out by the Coalition Provisional Authority, that they were not covered by the law of Iraq. Is that at the time, would that have been true?
You're referring, I think, to CPA 17.
Yes, right.
CPA 17 was something that covered contractors of all nationalities who were working in Iraq. It also covered armed forces personnel who were working in Iraq from various different countries. And it was sort of the precursor to a status of forces agreement. The status of forces agreement is usually a treaty or an executive agreement by which a country that sends its armed forces into another country agrees ahead of time what the jurisdiction over the personnel that they're sending will be in both a criminal and civil and tax kind of way. They tend to be pretty all-inclusive. In the absence of a sovereign state capable of negotiating a status of forces agreement, we got instead CPA Order 17, which tried to encapsulate some of the typical provisions of those agreements. And they do pretty routinely call for in-state immunity from local laws for the armed forces personnel and the contractors accompanying them. And what they provide instead is that the sending state will exert jurisdiction over the criminal acts of the people that it sends. While CPA was in force, it has been pretty widely reported that, at least as to the United States, and as far as I know for any other jurisdiction as well, there were no instances of the sending state enacting its own criminal jurisdiction over the things that went wrong. And so what you saw, I think, was a number of incidents that probably were worthy of some criminal investigation and potential prosecution go unanswered. And then we had, in September of 2007, the very heavily reported incident in Nisr Square. And that took place, yes, while CPA 17 was still in effect. And it also took place while the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act was in effect, and the UCMJ was in effect, two alternate means of obtaining criminal jurisdiction over the individuals alleged to have been responsible for the incident.
All right. Well, let's hold off on moving on to military law for a moment. Let me just ask one further question. Now,
sure.
As a result of now the relatively recently entered into status of forces agreement between the countries, now is it clear that now today, if such a thing would happen, that then the law of Iraq would apply?
Yes, that's quite clear. The one caveat that I would put on that is that on December 31st of last year, the day before the change in jurisdiction was to take place, the Iraqi government, the Minister of Interior, issued a statement withholding some of its implementation of what they described as the ministerial aspects of Iraqi law, things like customs, tariffs, weapons, licenses, registrations, and those kinds of things. Implementation of that aspect of Iraqi jurisdiction is currently held in abeyance, I think, while Iraq works out exactly how its own mechanisms of that sort of civil justice and to some extent criminal justice are going to be enacted over U.S. contractors in other countries. But on the order on December 31st did say, however, that the rest of the Iraqi criminal and civil code would apply. So if we're asking if Nisr Square happens tomorrow, is that covered by Iraqi law? The answer, according to the terms of the SOFA, is pretty clearly yes.
And is it retrospective in the sense that events that took place prior to the status of forces agreement, could go back and make charges, or does anything anything that happened before that, is that not covered?
David, I'll tell you, that's a great question. And as a lawyer who spends an awful lot of her day working on those issues, I'll tell you squarely, we don't know. It is not clear from the terms of the SOFA. It's not entirely clear either on review of the Iraqi Constitution or the Iraqi Penal Code. The question is whether or not Iraq's criminal justice system is going to have the same sort of ex post facto limitation that we have in the United States. In the United States, it's a very clear constitutional, longstanding aspect of our system that if the law changes tomorrow, you're not in trouble for something that you did yesterday. But it's not clear if that's going to be the case in Iraq. We have certain assurances, and I know that the State Department is working very closely with the Iraqi officials, and that this is sort of a due process question that as Americans we hold dear, and that most of the rest of the industrialized world also applies to their criminal justice systems. But there hasn't been any assurance yet in writing that the criminal jurisdiction that became the word of the day as of January 1st of this year won't be retroactive in Iraq. So it's possible that it could be.
Let me very, very quickly introduce again our guest, Tara Lee. She is an attorney. She's a partner in the firm DLA Piper LLC. She's also a former military lawyer, and she works does a lot of work dealing with defense industry issues and government contractors. She's done a lot of speaking and writing about issues related to battlefield contractors, oversight, and liability. And that's, in a sense, what we're talking about here this morning, is the question being, what kind of law covers independent contractors, security contractors working in another country like Iraq, for example? And it wouldn't necessarily have to be Iraq. It could be someplace else. And that part of the reason that so much attention is being focused on this right at the moment, although, as I said, it was a discussion that people were having before, a lot of attention focused on this because of this particular case that took place in the September 2007, the shooting that took place in Baghdad involving some employees of Blackwater, the private security firm. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go on and let me ask you then about military law. And you mentioned two things. There's the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and then there's the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. And it would seem that seem clear that either one or both of these things would apply to uniform soldiers, military personnel, no question about it. But here, again, when it comes to the private contractors, particularly, and here one, I suppose, has to draw the distinction between who hired them. Then the question is, well, does, even though here these are people that are doing a job, maybe doing the same job that soldiers do, but they're not soldiers, so does military law apply to them?
It's a great question, David. The sort of timeline that you see where we have a MEJA Expansion Act and we have a UCMJ Additional Jurisdictional Clause passed, MEJA was expanded in 2005, the UCMJ was expanded in 2007, and those are both very clearly attempts by our Congress to address what is perceived to be a gap in jurisdiction over contractors that are operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. The jurisdictional language of MEJA actually says individuals who are in support of the mission of the Department of Defense overseas. Now, it's clear from the legislative history of the Defense Authorization Act passing in 2005, which is when we first saw the expansion of the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, clearly that language is intended to cover contractors. The argument that lawyers get to make, because of the way it's phrased, is that a contractor who is on a Department of State contract, for example, the Blackwater contractors who were acting in Nisour Square in September of 2007, there is an argument you can make that says a Department of State contractor is not in support of the mission of the Department of Defense overseas. But I'll tell you that I've read the legislative history of that act, and it's very clear that what Congress intended was to reach everyone we're sending to Iraq. So you'll see those motions being raised in the Nisour Square criminal cases that are pending and in the other criminal cases that are pending to the extent that they apply. In the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that's a means of justice that has historically only been applied to active duty armed services members. After Vietnam and during Vietnam, there were a few cases where military prosecutors tried to bring criminal cases against civilians. They were things like a wife who was stationed in Germany with her husband commits murder of her husband. There were things like a seaman working for the military airlift command, a civilian contractor type, commits a crime on a base. There was sort of a smattering of prosecutions post-Vietnam that were brought under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because there is language in the existing Uniform Code of Military Justice that would suggest that civilians traveling with the forces could be tried by court-martial. There's also, incidentally, language that would suggest that enemy combatant civilians can be tried by court-martial as well, but those really hadn't been tried with the exception of a couple of cases post-Vietnam, and in each case post-Vietnam, the cases have been overturned for an absence of jurisdiction. So Congress in 2007 was looking at what they thought was a gap in jurisdiction and reacted to that by expanding the reach of the Uniform Code of Military Justice to reach all persons serving with or accompanying an armed force in the field, which very clearly expands the jurisdiction of the military justice system to reach the contractors that are accompanying the armed forces. That's much broader, but I can tell you that I think those prosecutions will be much rarer for reasons of military expediency and limitations on the authority of the individual commanding officers who might bring those charges. I think if you want to see what is likely to go forward, what I've seen so far suggests to me that we're going to see far more prosecutions under the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act than we will see under the UCMJ. But arguably, both of those would apply if a Nisour Square incident were to take place tomorrow.
And just one further question. I have a caller here, I promise. I'm not going to make this person wait forever. But is there any way in which American U.S. criminal law could apply to an act like this, or because it took place outside of the United States on foreign soil, does that mean that U.S. criminal law doesn't apply?
Yeah, let me do a better job of explaining MEJA, because what you just described, that's what MEJA is.
Oh, okay.
MEJA is not actually intended for armed forces personnel.
Okay.
It is specifically intended for people traveling with the armed forces who are overseas and would normally be outside the territorial reach of the U.S. criminal system. So what you see in MEJA is the American criminal system, charges like manslaughter, murder, the Anti-Drug Act, the kinds of things we would normally charge as crimes in the U.S., transported out to wherever we have people operating in support of the mission of the Department of Defense. And candidly, what we lacked in MEJA was not jurisdiction. It was an absence of prosecutorial will. Prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office are organized by geographic jurisdiction, right? You have a U.S. attorney who is in charge of the Eastern District of Virginia. You have a U.S. attorney who is in charge of the Western District of Virginia and so forth throughout the United States. We did not have a U.S. attorney specifically assigned to be in charge of, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, and so you didn't see any prosecutors out there seeking out a caseload based on Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. You had instead a case-by-case review where the jurisdiction could be brought either in the D.C. circuit or in the hometown of the individual who was to be charged. So it took a pretty big incident to rise to the level of media attention, political will, and prosecutorial will that brought us the major prosecutions in Nisour Square.
Okay, so just one more quick question. Then.
Sure.
Then I guess it was my understanding that for some time, certainly even prior to what happened in 2007, that there was this debate going on, that there was this open question about just what sort of law would apply to private security contractors operating in a place like Iraq. It sounds to me like from what you were saying, that as far as you're concerned, if someone had asked you that question, you would have said, as far as I'm concerned, it's very clear that the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act applies to them. No question. There's no, in your mind, you might have said, well, as far as I'm concerned, there's no debate about this. MEJA covers them, and that's it.
It depends when you asked me.
Oh, okay.
MEJA wasn't expanded until the 2005 Defense Authorization Act.
Right.
So the debate that you remember is one that was pretty robust from 2003 to 2005, and even before that in Afghanistan. So until we had an expansion of MEJA, and there are some, by the way, who would argue that the expansion of MEJA currently only reaches Department of Defense contractors. You could certainly interpret the language that way, although it's clear that the legislative intent was to reach all contractors. From 2001, for example, through 2005, that's what you're remembering as the debate about whether they were reachable at all, because there was no UCMJ jurisdiction. There was no MEJA expansion until 2005, and they were operating under CPA 17 in Iraq.
All right. So from 2005 on, you would say, as far as you're concerned, it's clear MEJA would cover it, and that you would say that it would be your opinion in this particular case that we're talking about, the 2007 incident, that those people should be covered under MEJA, although, as you say, there may still be some disagreement about because I believe that these people were working for the State Department, there's going to be some, I'm sure their attorneys no doubt would raise this issue that, well, because they were working for the State Department, that MEJA doesn't cover them.
Correct.
All right. We have a caller here in Thomasboro. We'll talk with them right now on line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting. Haven't been totally involved from day one, David. First one, let's see. Let's go back. We invaded Iraq without justification based on battle plans we started in the 1990s that were supposed to be implemented while Bill Clinton was still there. We killed men, women, and children without justification. We've occupied houses. We've arrested people without warrants. We've broken down doors and gone in without justification. We've thoroughly contaminated the environment in violation of our own orders and regulations. We have senior Department of Defense regulations that are being violated with total immunity. Medical care is denied to both civilians and military. And then on top of that, what we have is what you keep referring to, contractors. Contractors are our own mercenaries. For example, Blackwater Aegis, I mean, they're the cream of the crop of special forces that are traded over to work with Blackwater out of the military, and then they'll come back to the military to avoid liability. It seems like a real mess. And then we have the Status of Forces Agreement saying, well, we can do what we want, and we can commit all the crimes we want under their jurisdiction because it falls under ours. And we wonder why the world is irritated and why this is all wrong. I guess I just like come back to reality on this thing is, what justification do we have for anything that we've done, and what justification do we have for all of our mercenaries killing everybody, including murdering one of the local boys here from Thomasboro, who was killed and shot in the back, you know, because he was going to blow the water in Blackwater. How do we justify all this? I mean, we've got to have some legal rationale, and there is none yet, and there never will be. And I'd just like to have the guest comments on all this, please.
Well, Ms. Lee, you can take that on any way you like.
Sure. There are a couple parts of it that I probably feel comfortable and qualified to address. And then, honestly, there are just some aspects that are, these are very tough questions, right? These are the mission that we set out, that we attempted to accomplish in both Iraq and Afghanistan, is a very complicated one. I think that the fairest thing that you could say is that the government set out trying to do something very hard and to do it with the resources that they had available. And what developed in Iraq and Afghanistan that was different from the problems and difficulties that you come into in any armed conflict, in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think it's fair to say that what was different is that we went into the conflict using a higher portion of civilian contractors in support of the mission than had been
mercenaries. Mercenaries, please.
Well, let me correct you on mercenaries. I have a long background in human rights law, and I'm going to read to you from a human rights report on the term mercenaries. The Geneva Conventions, mercenaries are non-uniform citizens who take a direct part in hostilities and are specially recruited to fight in an armed conflict. I have read from first syllable to last syllable all of the contracts that cover the private security contractors operating in Iraq and Afghanistan, and great pains are taken to contract civilians in a manner that will, to the maximum extent possible, preclude them from taking direct part in hostilities. We could, mind you, if we had wanted to buttress the ranks of either the Army or the Marine Corps in order to, say, better have a larger force participating in, say, the Battle of Fallujah in 2005. There are certainly companies, both overseas and in the United States, who have at their disposal civilian individuals with all the right training to perform that mission. But we have really specific and detailed limitations on using them in that capacity in the United States. We have limitations on contractors performing any inherently governmental functions. And I'll be the first one to tell you that the inherently governmental functions tests are sometimes really difficult to concern or to discern. But direct part in hostilities is a pretty clear absolute bar. Where that has gotten confusing, certainly in the media reports, is in the role of private security contractors who are providing defensive protection to security convoys. And I am sure that there are individuals on the ground in both Iraq and Afghanistan who might have trouble distinguishing on site between the contractors in a defensive mission and some of the military in directly participating in hostilities. But I think the circumstances where that has been confusing or difficult to discern are very, very rare. For the most part, in large percentage numbers, contractors in Iraq are not even armed. Something like 90-plus percent of the civilian contractors that are supporting the forces either in Iraq or Afghanistan are not the armed security contractors that we envision when we picture Blackwater. Those missions are actually very, very small numbers of contractors, down in the hundreds or 1,000, maybe 2,000 total. And honestly, I think that we, given the amount of attention and intellectual discussion that has focused on that particular role, I think we're going to see less and less of it going forward. I think it can be scored in one of the sort of lessons learned category about where we're comfortable having contractors operate. But I will tell you from personal experience that that is not for lack of very, very specific rules for the escalation of force being in place and currently a significant amount of regulation as to exactly what missions they can do, and that's all for the purpose of ensuring that they cannot act on behalf of the United States as mercenaries.
I want to thank the caller. I don't know if you did you want to do a quick follow-up?
Yeah, I understand what you said there, but again, the operational experience was substantially different personally when I was in Iraq during Desert Storm and talking to those and working with those since then in the medical care. We have to come back to the legal justification for everything we've done, and that's what keeps getting ignored. We invaded Iraq and Afghanistan based on plans wrote in the 1990s, and General Franks totally acknowledges that in the 911 Commission report on page 336. We violated their human rights, our civil rights. We violated our own constitutional rights that we don't expend upon them. We've contaminated the environment, and yet what we have is continued justification for the use of mercenaries, and they truly are mercenaries. Bar none, they truly are mercenaries. And our military, in a continued combat action that's resulting in horrific casualties of all types. I mean, we're looking at U.S. casualty count now from the VA acknowledging Iraqi freedom, enduring freedom, of well over 350,000. From Desert Storm, the BINS report from the VA came out here about a month ago, totally acknowledging close to 300,000. the millions of civilian casualties, and we keep going around trying to justify what we have and what we've done while we violate our own regulations. And at some point, something's got to be done. And I know this is a sore point on me, having been involved on a daily basis and actually having been asked to go to Blackwater as a special operations guy years ago, and we refused to do it because it just wasn't worthwhile. Anyhow, thank you very much, and thanks for the call.
I appreciate the comments. I know the caller raises a number of issues far beyond the scope of what here we're talking about this morning, and gets us into all sorts of other areas. I don't know if there's anything else you would want to add past what you've already said.
I do want to thank the caller for the question. I'm always very open to hearing those viewpoints, and I want to emphasize that the question of whether or not we use contractors at all and in what roles we use them is a very timely question. It is brought to bear, and it is worth reconsidering again every time we have one of these incidents. But the framework that I always suggest is this. I operate from a human rights background, from a military law background, and like most people, when considering questions related to war, one of the objectives is that we want to lower what the caller described as the casualty counts, both for the United States forces that are serving and for the civilians that are in the area where the war is being conducted. And sometimes the academics that go through these questions, and even some of my colleagues in the human rights world that go through these questions, aren't necessarily operating from that rubric when they suggest that we remove all contractors from the battlefield. The occurrence of a disproportionate use of force that will harm or kill a civilian is by no means limited to contractors operating in defensive roles around security convoys. My experience in military law and my study of the conflicts that we've had with the United States forces involved in history suggests to me that the armed forces numbers of disproportionate use of force that harms civilians are probably quite higher than the number of incidents that we've seen contractors involved in since they've been in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is true in many cases that the contractors are 35 to 40-year-old former American military people who have 10, 15, sometimes 20 years of experience. And very often the Marines on the front line are 19, 20-year-olds who are on their first tour. These are not easy distinctions to make when we ask people in a conflict environment to distinguish a threat from a non-threat. There are always decisions that come out wrong, and there are always tragic stories. But they're by no means limited to Blackwater or to any of the other security contractors. And so I tend to be a voice that urges some caution when we are asking our government to pull the contractors from the battlefield or to restrict the roles that we allow them to serve in. I tend to be of the opinion that the threat we face is one with very little historic parallel, and that it calls on us to use the best resources that we have, whether they're civilian, military, or other.
Well, just I want to go back to something that you said in response to the caller. Did I hear you, though, saying that you think that perhaps as a result of experiences like this that we're talking about, that in the future that the United States would perhaps be less likely to employ civilian contractors in the kind of roles that we're talking about, that is, people who are carrying weapons and mm-hmm. who might well be involved in using them, as you pointed out, and mm-hmm. as I think people recognize, that the ratio between private employees of private contractors and uniformed personnel in Iraq is the highest that it's ever been, but that most of the people that we're talking about they're not carrying guns, and they're not doing that kind of thing. They're involved in equipment's maintenance and feeding the soldiers and doing all kinds of stuff like that. So it sounds as if though you're saying that in the future perhaps they would be we might be more reluctant to employ people in those kinds of roles where we might end up in a kind of a situation like this.
I think that's very true. I absolutely think, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think we're headed into a period of overcorrection. During the presidential elections, you could hear almost every candidate pledging to reduce the number of contractors, to cut back the number of contractors, and very rarely was that ever connected to some with any sort of symmetry as a solution to a particular problem. you know, it's sort of an emotional response to the publicity, and I think in large part to the publicity about the Nisar Square incident. To me, the correct call was for additional accountability, for additional prosecutorial and investigatory resources, because we do owe it to the civilians in the countries where we're operating to hold our people accountable. And we have the jurisdictional mechanisms to do that. What we lacked was any sort of visible action taking place that could reassure the civilian populace that the American justice system was looking into the potential wrongdoing, investigating it, and punishing it where necessary. We went far too long with the perception being in place that that wasn't going to happen. And what we're left with now is an overcorrection on both sides. You have the Iraq SOFA, where the terms that the Iraqi government insisted on included a specific reservation of contractors. The current agreement that went into place continues the immunity, so to speak, but the preference for American jurisdiction over the American service members, what it takes out is the same thing for contractors. And it's the first agreement we've had with any country where contractors are treated differently in terms of jurisdiction and immunity than the armed forces that they're serving with. And my sense is that's a direct response to the Nisar Square incident and how long it took us to enact our jurisdictional mechanisms for accountability. And I see it beyond just criminal prosecution and jurisdiction aspects. I do think that there will be congressional calls to minimize the number of contractors, and I haven't seen them connected logically to because this is the best way to do it going forward or because this is the best resource to deploy going forward. And I don't think the threat is getting any less grave. I don't think the challenge is getting any easier. I think it's important that we do fundamentally rethink the way we use contractors, but I'd like to see us do that in sort of a reasoned and deliberate way. And instead, what I suspect is that we're going to see an automatic overcorrection. I hope not, but that's what I suspect.
Let me just, we have some other callers. Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Tara Lee. She is an attorney. She's a partner in the firm DLA Piper LLC. She's also a former military lawyer. She has particular experience in areas that relate to defense industry issues and government contractors. She's done a lot of speaking and writing on issues related to battlefield contractors, oversight, and liability. She served in the U.S. Navy. She's a graduate of the Naval Academy. She was in the JAG Corps, the Judge Adjutant General Corps. During that time, she received an award from the American Trial Lawyers Association for Outstanding Military Trial Advocate. She's also taught at UC Davis Law School and McGeorge School of Law at University of Pacific. She's a member of the Bar Association's, the American Bar Association's Standing Committee on Law and National Security, and in that capacity, she's led teams of attorneys in producing white papers that have to do with the application of military law, both the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act to contractors on the battlefield. Questions welcome. We do have several, and we'll try to get everybody in, but we are short on time here. We're in our last 10 minutes. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, caller in Columbus, Ohio, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Yes? I had a couple of things I wanted to bring up, one of which is my absolute disgust at the fact that after spending $500 billion for years and years and years on the defense budget, the most we're able to muster is 200,000 troops to do battle. As I recall, over the years, there was adamant arguments put forward that we needed to have the capability to fight war on two fronts. This is back in the late 80s, early 90s. And if all we can get together is 200,000, it sounds like we've been sold a bill of goods. The other point that I wanted to make was that one of the more significant areas that was neglected in bringing all these contractors in was a lack of uniformity. And I'm talking about dress. The contractors, Blackwater or whoever else, are unidentifiable. And because of their inability to be recognized, when they did misbehave, there was no way to determine. As far as the Iraqi people were concerned. I think that they may have had the ability to recognize soldiers as soldiers, but when security people were running around, they had no way of knowing whether they were part of the U.S. or part of Al-Qaeda or part of whatever. One of the results of that is what happened when they, just before the four contractors were brutalized, that escalated and whipped up the country about how terrible things were in Iraq. They couldn't be identified. Hello?
Yes?
Hi.
Okay. Sorry.
It's interesting because I sometimes hear the reverse of that issue. I often hear the complaint that they look too much like armed forces members. The Geneva Convention.
They look like thugs, but they're not wearing uniforms.
Right. And that in part is so that they'll comply with the Geneva Conventions. There are very strict restrictions on how much they can look like U.S. forces. And the various different companies incorporate that concern differently. And it's interesting your comment, because what I hear more often is the complaint that they're indistinguishable from the armed forces, and the Geneva Conventions require very specifically that they be distinguishable. So it's a balance that has to be struck, I think, and you're right to identify it as an issue. It's one that's very serious. I think perhaps a better way going forward to make them distinguishable is to have them function in roles that are clearly distinguishable from the military roles. And that has to happen from the very beginning of the conflict. I think if you can't really correct that once the horse is out of the barn, so to speak.
Right. One other point, if I could. The other thing, and I don't have hard numbers, but I have read a number of things that have made indications in this direction. The payroll for the contractors that we have over there equals or exceeds the payroll for the military, even though soldiers outnumber contractors, 5-1?
Mm-hmm.
And that really has a, aside from a demoralizing impact on the troops there, that they're in the middle of it and they're getting their rate, and contractors whipping around,
yeah,
having fun are getting paid 5-10 times what they're getting paid.
Yeah, you know,
it's had an adverse impact on retention, and it's just, aside from oversight, it's a very problematic area.
Yeah, I agree with you completely about the, I am very, as a person who was in the military for 12 years, I'm very actively concerned about the demoralizing impact that those kinds of numbers have. I spend a lot of my time trying to correct people's understanding of the numbers, and I think in part they stem from one flawed premise that is an important way of distinguishing Iraq from all the prior conflicts. Every time you see those 5-1 numbers, bear in mind that in the prior conflicts, let's take World War II and Vietnam as the most recent examples. When we counted the number of contractors in World War II, we counted the number who were involved in supporting the mission during the war, separately from counting the ones that were involved in reconstruction. In World War II, there was a definitive end, a peace treaty, and from there, it was essentially American contractors that did all of the reconstruction missions throughout Europe, and to some extent, that's been the case in every conflict that we've had. In Iraq, for example, the reconstruction mission has been taking place side by side with the military mission from moment one. And so the number of contractors, though it appears inflated, is being counted differently. And when they're counting those dollars and reporting the numbers about to compare the salaries, they're including everyone that's involved in reconstruction, as well as all the equipment that's involved in reconstruction, as well as the money that's going to our local Iraqi subcontractors involved in reconstruction. So they're very, very misleading numbers, but I share your concern because I agree that it's been a sort of disheartening experience to hear those kinds of reports for the active duty military.
Yeah. Again, I want to thank the caller again and mention again we're getting very short on time. We have about 5 minutes left. We'll get our next caller in line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I'm a professor of law here at the University of Illinois, and I teach our courses on international law and human rights. And I've been qualified as an expert on the laws of war and testified now in 5 military court-martial proceedings. And I can state categorically that with respect to the Geneva law that you mentioned, every armed contractor in Iraq is a mercenary unless he or she fulfills two conditions. One, they have to be a citizen of the United States. Two, they have to be officially hired by an agency of the United States government to provide protection to United States government personnel. Other than that, all the rest of them are mercenaries. That does not mean that they are war criminals, but they are mercenaries, and that's exactly why in the Status of Forces Agreement, the government of Iraq insisted, and finally the Bush administration went along with it, that they all be subjected to the jurisdiction of Iraqi courts, which is precisely the case today. And I do hope that Iraq will proceed to prosecute each and every one of these mercenaries committing war crimes over there against the innocent people of Iraq. And you really should be ashamed of yourself as an attorney, fellow attorney, and officer of the court to get up here and be defending mercenaries, mercenarism, and war crimes. Thank you.
Well, you can respond to that any way you like.
I'm happy to. It's not an uncommon sentiment. And as a person who reveres the law of war and who served in the military alongside a lot of people who have been harmed in Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm always very gentle in my responses to that emotion because I know that it comes from a really good place. I do think that's the kind of emotion that leads to what I was calling overcorrection, because the Status of Forces Agreement that the professor is excited about because he hopes that it'll prosecute the mercenaries, it's been drafted so that it also covers every contractor, every person who's there to fix the IT server, and it covers the grantees as well. I've done legal advice in the last few weeks for a number of humanitarian organizations that are nonprofits that are working to get food and clothing and shelter to people in places like Iraq, and they're now going to be subject to Iraqi criminal jurisdiction, and they're really concerned about the human rights reports that have come out about the criminal justice system there in the last month. So, you know, there's overcorrection that's possible that comes from feelings that are that strong, but I do understand where they come from. The one thing I would say in closing is I've got to continue to object to the categorization of mercenary because the definition that I read explaining that private security contractors are not mercenaries comes from Human Rights First and the New America Foundation reports that have spent a lot of time studying the issue and reached that conclusion. But as with most things in law, it's possible that different minds can disagree. Perhaps as a closing comment, the one thing that I would add is that my hope is that these kinds of debates continue. I think you guys are doing a great thing by discussing the issues and by bringing in the different viewpoints. I think it's important that we remain aware of the unintended consequences of our reactions to these types of things. I would agree with everyone who hopes that the Blackwater-type missions can be taken over by the military, but I would caution that when we do that, we have to be aware that the military or any other organization has a limited number of core competencies, and it can only have one primary mission. So every function that we decide we will redline and reserve for the military is going to move the military farther away from its primary mission. And in support of that mission, I do think that there are roles that contractors can appropriately serve. And I want to say that I think we have the appropriate criminal justice mechanisms in place to deal with things when they go wrong. But that very, very rarely will any of those resolutions satisfy everybody.
We're to the point where we have about a minute or a minute and a half. And just to go back to where we started to talk about the case of the Blackwater employees that are charged in these 2007 shootings, they have now been charged here in the United States. And the last story I read, or one of the stories, said that actually trial date had been set, or a date for the start of the trial had been set, and that was more than a year away. It was in, in February of the year 2010. And I assume that, there is the desire to make sure that all involved in this case have time to prepare the case. And I just wonder, as you think about that, does it seem like it's very clear how that's going to go? Or would there still be questions, particularly questions raised by the defense, about whether indeed particular laws, and I guess here we're talking about the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, whether in fact that that applies?
Yeah, I think it's by no means clear how it'll come out. I think it's very, very likely that it'll be an unsatisfying result for everyone who's watching it on both sides of the issue. And I think you will see, or you very well should see, motions that address whether or not this is the appropriate jurisdiction. And I think that's a big question, one that's worthy of further consideration, because if you notice how they end up having to charge these crimes in order to bring them into the American criminal justice system, they become manslaughter charges, where you have to prove as an element of the crime that this happened in the heat of passion. That's a tricky translation of on the battlefield, you know? Battlefield killings have their own sort of issues, and when you're trying to allege a mistaken, disproportionate use of force under a U.S. criminal statute that is intended for a heat of passion manslaughter crime and incorporates with it some sentence issues related to the Anti-Drug Act and things like that, I mean, these cases are going to be very hard to successfully manage in an American court system and to bring to a satisfactory resolution one way or the other. So it doesn't surprise me that it's going to take a year, and I think it's going to be a year of very, very active litigation.
All right. Our guest this morning, Tara Lee, is a partner with the law firm DLA Piper LLC. She's also a former military lawyer. She's particularly spent time working in areas that relate to defense industry issues and government contractors. She's done a lot of speaking and writing on these issues that we're talking about, battlefield contractors, oversight, and liability. And Ms. Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.